Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Katie Robbins of the National Coalition Healthcare Now, who takes a critical look at the compromises being made in the U.S. Senate to put forward a health care reform bill acceptable to conservative Democrats. Anna Keenan of Australia, one of eight international activists engaged in a water-only fast, who explains why she's protesting inaction on global warming at the UN Climate Change Conference in Copenhagen, Denmark. And Tarso Ramos of Political Research Associates and Reverend Kapia Kaoma of Zambia, who discuss the links between U.S. Christian right groups and the drive in Uganda to pass a bill that would impose the death penalty for homosexual activity. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Thousands of Iranian opposition activists flooded university campuses in the face of repression by government-sponsored militia groups to mark National Students' Day in early December. The day honors students killed by the Shah's security forces in 1953. Basij militias used chains and stun guns against protesters while police arrested hundreds. In a sign of growing militancy, protesters burned posters of President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad and Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. Activists also shouted, "God is great and death to the dictator." The government has also accused students of burning photos of Ayatollah Khomeini, founder of the Iranian Republic. The students deny the charge and say the government is using the accusation as a pretext for repression. In a new report, Amnesty International claims that more than 4,000 people have been arrested in Iran since the disputed presidential election on June 12th. Nearly 70 activists have died in protests over the last 6 months. Amnesty's Elise Auerbach observed, "The massive scale of these violations is impossible to hide, while calls for accountability and justice are growing both within and outside Iran." In a surprising twist at the end of Cambodia's first war crimes tribunal, Gongek Iu, better known as Doik, the head of the infamous Khmer Rouge S-21 prison where 15,000 people were tortured and killed, pled for his release. Up to the last day, 67-year-old Doik and his team of French and Cambodian lawyers had taken responsibility for the atrocities at the prison and sought forgiveness from victims. But at the last minute, Doik's lawyers insisted he was a scapegoat used by the Khmer Rouge. According to the Christian Science Monitor, the trial was attended by 28,000 people during 77 days of hearings. Thousands more tuned into live radio and television broadcasts of the proceedings. More than 2 million Cambodians died in the genocide in the late 1990s, referred to as the killing fields. Cambodian Prime Minister Hun Sen wants to prevent the arrest of additional Khmer Rouge suspects. There is particular concern about Chia Sim, head of the Cambodian Senate, and Hung Samrin, president of the National Assembly. Both were military commanders with the Khmer Rouge. 30 years after the atrocities, many of Doik's surviving victims remain traumatized. Chum Mei, who survived the S-21 prison, told the LA Times, "No one is happy about Doik's request to be freed. In fact, most people want him killed." Prosecutors are seeking a 40-year sentence for Doik. The Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, the spiritual leader of the Anglican Communion, has rebuked the Episcopal Diocese of Los Angeles for naming a lesbian, Mary Glasspool, as suffragan bishop. Williams, under fire from Anglican conservatives, says naming Glasspool as an assistant bishop in the L.A. diocese raises serious questions for the global Anglican Communion. Glasspool currently serves as canon, or senior assistant to the Episcopal Diocese of Maryland. She was elected to the suffragan position at a diocese convention in early December. The convention elected a second woman, Diane Jardine Bruce, to serve as another suffragan. They are the first two women elected to the post of assistant bishop in the 114-year history of the diocese. Bishop J. John Brown, head of the Los Angeles Episcopal Diocese, told the LA Times, "I don't foresee how an autonomous Episcopal church should be influenced by other people's fears of sexuality or homosexuality. I am moving forward completely dedicated to Diane Jardine Bruce and Mary Glasspool, a woman who happens to be a lesbian." However, Anglican conservatives were pleased with Williams' blunt statement. Reverend Randall Harmon, a theological advisor to the South Carolina Episcopal Diocese, noted, "I think Los Angeles underestimated the significance of what they are doing in an international context." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
with several conservative Democratic senators and one independent threatening to withhold their votes needed to pass health care reform legislation, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid and President Obama signaled their surrender in pushing for the establishment of a government-run public insurance option. An 11th-hour alternative to the public option to allow uninsured Americans ages 55 to 64 to purchase Medicare coverage was also shot down when Connecticut Independent Senator Joseph Lieberman opposed the measure, although he had publicly supported a similar plan in September. With little chance that any Republicans will cast votes in support of health reform, all 60 senators in the Democratic caucus, which includes two independents, are needed to defeat a GOP filibuster and allow a final vote to proceed. Any legislation that is adopted by the Senate must then be reconciled with the House health reform bill passed in November. Progressive advocacy groups campaigning to provide universal coverage to all Americans while reducing skyrocketing costs have expressed frustration that Congress is being held hostage to a tiny minority of legislators determined to derail even weak reform measures. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Katie Robbins, Assistant National Coordinator with Healthcare Now, a coalition advocating a single-payer healthcare system. She talks about the inadequacies of the compromises being debated and what her group is doing to strengthen the prospects of more comprehensive reform.
The conversation that started at the beginning of this year was such that single payer was not to be considered, but that the Democratic Party would be pushing what they call a public option. Nobody really understood what the public option was. They claimed that it would provide power to contain costs, because it would compete with the for-profit companies in a way that would drive costs down. That was never clear from the beginning. And now, you know, the idea of the public option is such that it would be available to very few people. The Congressional Budget Office estimates 5 to 6 million people would be able to actually enroll in the public option. And now we're hearing that it's not even going to be a real public program, that it would be managed by private insurance companies. And it's not an option because it's not available to all people. If you have insurance through your employer, you would not be able to enroll in the public option. So it's not a choice. And then this new proposal for the Medicare buy-in, well, the idea of lowering the eligibility age for Medicare to 55 really only works if it's mandatory for all people to participate in it. Otherwise, it becomes the place where all the sickest patients get dumped. And that might be okay for sick people, since Medicare is often better and more secure than private coverage, but it would drive total health care costs and premiums up, not down. And what we advocate for is Medicare for everybody, so that there's one risk pool where the young and the old, the healthy and the sick, balance out the cost to be able to guarantee health care to everyone. So even the idea of a Medicare buy-in, where it at first sounds like we're headed in the right direction, it looks like because of the risk pool being primarily people who have high health care needs, resulting in high health care costs, that the premiums to buy into Medicare would be unaffordable to people, and that without significant government subsidies, it wouldn't really be sustainable. So the devil's in the details with both the idea of a public option or the Medicare buy-in, and what we're seeing is that they're all benefiting the insurance companies from avoiding the sickest people so that they can continue to make the profits that they do.
We have the lobbyists who are very successful at influencing Congress to limit any meaningful reform in our healthcare system. But at the same time, people in the country aren't stupid. And if there is a very weak and almost meaningless healthcare reform bill passed, and it really makes no difference in their lives, the Democrats and the politicians who vote such legislation in are liable to be punished in the next election. So, I mean, there is a real disconnect here, and there's going to be some fallout.
I agree. I think the Democratic Party is really, you know, putting another nail in the coffin, if you will. The idea that most of the proposals don't even go into effect until 2013, that we're still going to have 3 or 4 years of the same problem continuing and plaguing the American people without any relief, I can't imagine that that's going to work out favorably in the coming elections. Now, something that Fire Dog Lake and other single-payer advocates are saying is that we need to use this as a litmus test going into the next elections. Will you stand with single-payer advocates? Because we know that it's the solution, yet when it came down to it, our supporters of single-payer really just sort of rolled over and let the insurance companies dictate the reform. So, yeah, I agree. I think that the political fallout will be significant as people become disillusioned and frustrated that the crisis wasn't really addressed in this legislative moment.
There's an old adage that says you shouldn't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. And there are a lot of people out in the country suffering with no health insurance or inadequate health insurance. And there may be some good points in this bill, although they don't come close to addressing the real crisis. But does your group favor approving an imperfect bill and moving incrementally into the future to really get the dramatic change in the system we need? Or would you rather just see this whole effort collapse?
For healthcare now, we really feel like, you know, if there was something about this bill that we felt would work in the long run to provide a cost-effective and humane system to provide healthcare to everyone in this country, then, you know, we would have to really consider it. For example, if the public option were actually the public option people advocated for at the beginning of this, with choice for anyone to opt in, and that would be a different discussion. But right now, we are opposed to this legislation, despite the argument that it's going to help some people. We just think that overall it's setting meaningful reform back, and so we do think that continuing to work for what we know is right is critical, because eventually this reform will be unsustainable and we'll be having this conversation as a nation again, maybe not a decade, maybe even sooner.
That was Katie Robbins, Assistant National Coordinator for Healthcare Now. Contact the group at 1-800-453-1305 or visit their website at healthcare-now.org. Thousands of climate activists have descended on Copenhagen, Denmark, for the United Nations Climate Change Conference, where delegates from more than 190 nations are negotiating a treaty to replace the Kyoto Protocol, which expires in 2012. 110 heads of state are expected to arrive in the final days of the UN conference, with the goal of overcoming major differences between industrialized nations and developing countries that are pressuring wealthy governments to pledge more funds to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Among the thousands in Copenhagen are eight individuals who began a water-only fast on November 6th in an effort to pressure world leaders to take the steps necessary to combat devastating climate change. They are calling their action Climate Justice Fast and have been joined by others around the world who have opted to fast either long-term or short-term in solidarity. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with one of those fasting in Copenhagen, Anna Keenan, a 24-year-old activist from Queensland, Australia. She participated with an estimated 100,000 activists in a spirited march and rally on December 12th to support the demands of the most threatened nations for immediate and far-reaching action. Keenan and the other long-term fasters are under medical supervision and taking salt supplements to protect their health, but no food or liquid aside from water. Keenan explains why she decided to engage in the fast and what she believes is the necessary outcome of the UN climate talks.
I've taken on this hunger strike of over 40 days because I think that it's the only form of action that we have left available to us. I'm a climate activist, and I have been for many years. I've taken so many different forms of activism that it's not funny. I don't see politics changing as a result of much of it, though. I've given presentations in high schools about climate science. I've sat on government advisory boards and written government advisory papers. I've worked for professional NGOs, and I've been arrested in civil disobedience on top of a coal train. Despite all of these different forms of activism going on, I don't see politics changing fast enough, so I wanted to do the most that I, as an individual, could do, and to really demonstrate the dedication and the willingness to change that there is in the world. People have contacted us saying, you guys are making me reconsider, you know, the purpose of my life and the direction of my life. You know, the reason that myself and Sarah and the others, like Paul Connor in Australia as well, are doing this is because we want to demonstrate that we're committed to the climate change movement with our lives, and it's what we want to do with our lives is work until climate change is solved. And so people all around the world are contacting us and saying that, you know, we agree with you and we want to join the climate movement.
Anna Keenan, are there specific things you're calling for? I know the small island nations are calling for a rise of no more than 1.5 degrees Celsius rather than 2 degrees Celsius, or they'll all be underwater. And there are different demands for payments from the rich countries to the poor countries, and the financial commitments so far are nowhere near what's needed. So what do you think?
We stand in absolute solidarity with the poorest and most vulnerable countries on the planet. We support 100% the positions of the small island nations in this, you know, the most vulnerable. We think it's totally unacceptable for a single nation to go underwater for a problem that they did not cause. And we think that the survival of entire nations is quite simply not negotiable. We can't just negotiate away the existence of the Maldives. So the Climate Justice Fast has agreed on a number of positions, and basically it's called the Climate Justice Fast. And our definition of climate justice means that those people and those nations who have caused the problem need to change their practices so that they're just and they're made right. And that means that we need to end the use of fossil fuels, which are causing climate change. We need to end deforestation, and we also need to end the rampant overconsumption that there is in our developed Western societies. We need to shift our very modus operandi of increasing GDP and increasing consumption, and that being, you know, our sole goal in life, to instead having our goal as being sustainability across our societies. And in terms of, you know, the political asks, we need to also, you know, to achieve justice, those people and countries that have been done wrong against, we need to make things right for them. And so that means returning, you know, CO2 in the atmosphere to a safe level, to below 350 parts per million, and also repaying them for the damages that they've suffered, paying them, you know, $200 billion per year in adaptation and assistance so that they can develop in a clean way without making the same fossil fuel mistakes that our wealthy countries made in order to achieve our development. And that's just quite simply what is due to these countries.
You mentioned $200 billion annually, right? That's what the countries are saying?
That figure is taken from the Climate Action Network, which is a coalition of over 500 NGOs, and they're widely regarded as the most expert in policy matters.
What do you think about the job President Obama has done so far on the climate issue?
He's going to come to COP15. He's going to give a speech on climate change, and he's going to outline his position. And basically, we need to make sure that Obama is a leader on climate change instead of just, you know, a follower. He's got all of this inspirational power. He's got the power to change the American public. He's got the power to change everybody's opinions. And we need him to use that influence that he has over the American people, you know, to really help to bring them around to supporting climate action. I think that, you know, he made a lot of great promises during his election campaign, and now it's time for him to live up to that. Obama's talking about political pragmatism all the time, and he's hiding behind the Senate. He's saying, look, we can't go too far because the Senate might not approve it. He's got to have the courage and the moral leadership to be the leader on this issue, and I think that then he can inspire the American people, the Congress, and the Senate to get behind him.
That was Anna Keenan of Climate Justice Fast. For more information, visit the group's website at climatejusticefast.com. The Ugandan parliament is scheduled to vote on legislation early next year that would impose the death penalty for something termed aggravated homosexuality and could result in the execution of HIV-positive Ugandan citizens. While homosexuality is already considered a crime in Uganda that can lead to sentences of life in prison, the proposed bill that mandates execution has outraged human rights activists in Uganda and around the world. The U.S.-based group Political Research Associates has linked the drive to further criminalize lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender, or LGBT, citizens in Uganda, with several American Christian right groups that have focused their attention on influencing Ugandan political and religious affairs. In March 2009, the Family Life Network sponsored a conference titled Seminar in Exposing the Homosexuals' Agenda. Speaking at the seminar were two U.S. Christian right activists, Holocaust revisionist Scott Lively and Dan Schmierer of the ex-gay group Exodus International. Superstar evangelist Rick Warren of California's Saddleback Church has had a strong influence on African Christian groups. In 2008, during his visit to three African nations, including Uganda, Warren stated homosexuality is not a natural way of life and thus not a human right. Then many political and religious leaders worked to transform his words into action. Since reports about the gay death penalty legislation have surfaced in the U.S., Warren and several conservative congressmen who have been associated with groups backing the anti-homosexuality bill have been pressured to denounce the anti-gay measure. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Tarso Ramos, Executive Director of Political Research Associates, and Reverend Kapia Kayoma, an Anglican priest from Zambia who went undercover in Uganda. They talk about their investigation into the influence of U.S. Christian right groups on anti-gay activity in Uganda.
We initiated an investigation about a year and a half ago, and what we were trying to understand was how it was that U.S. Christian rightists who were organizing to oppose the full equality of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender persons within mainline Protestant denominations in the United States, the Episcopal Church, Lutheran Church, Presbyterian Church, and so forth, had managed to mobilize African clerics to weigh in on these U.S. culture war fights so effectively that they had threatened the possibility of global schism within the Anglican Communion, of which the Episcopal Church is a part, and had managed to block progress towards the ordination of gay clergy in several other mainline denominations in the United States. That investigation took us to the conferences of conservative organizations in the United States, and it took my colleague at Political Research Associates, Reverend Kapia Kayoma, on a trip through three countries in Africa, Uganda, Nigeria, and Kenya, interviewing religious leaders of a variety of different political persuasions and faiths to understand this relationship. And what we discovered through that investigation is that to a considerable degree, the fanning of the flames of vicious forms of homophobia in Africa is a byproduct or the collateral damage of our U.S. culture wars, where key figures on the U.S. Christian right and other U.S. conservatives, neoconservatives and others, have been fomenting homophobia among their religious colleagues in Africa for purposes of the domestic culture wars, but with the additional effect of really giving rise to vicious forms of homophobia in African countries, including in Uganda, where there is currently pending an almost unimaginable piece of legislation that further criminalizes an already highly persecuted LGBT community there, and until recently included provisions such as the death penalty, and also very stiff prison sentences for anyone who failed to turn into the authorities an individual they discovered as being homosexual within a 24-hour period.
Reverend Kayoma, tell us a little bit about your investigation and what you actually found when you went undercover in Uganda about the links to some segments of the conservative Christian churches here in the United States.
We have discovered that this is not just a political issue as some people want to make it. This is a religious issue. We have to mainly attack the religious figures behind it and ask them to denounce the bill, because it has more impact than asking a politician to do that. The religious right, they have invested so much in infrastructure in Africa. They have got schools. They have got universities now. They have got their radio stations in Uganda and across sub-Saharan Africa. They also have TV stations.
Reverend Kapia, would you like to comment on the conference that you witnessed there, which gave birth to this horrendous bill?
The conference was attended by high-profile persons, like members of parliament. We had the members representing the Minister of Education. We had some people from the police. We also had concerned parents and high-profile religious figures. And so you have Scott Lively goes to Uganda, Scott Lively himself claiming to Ugandans that he's the most learned on this issue. He knows more than anyone else in the world during that conference. And the organizer of that conference, who was Stephen Langer of the Family Life Network, was claiming that he has got authority from these people who know more than anyone else in the world about the question of gays, and what they say about it is true. So Lively had to address those first, and after addressing that, he had a four-hour meeting with the Parliament of Uganda, telling them about what he claimed to be the gay agenda to take over the world. After he left Uganda, we had a follow-up meeting, again, which we attended. And during that meeting, the organizer of the who called Scott Lively to come to Uganda, he himself said openly that they learned a lot from Scott Lively and that they are going to move forward to petition the government of Uganda to come up with a stiffer law against homosexuality.
Tarso Ramos, what is the leverage the Obama administration has to influence the direction of things in Uganda with regard to this current bill being considered by their parliament?
U.S. funds through our global HIV programs, these PEPFAR funds, have funded some of these projects and some of these leaders who are fomenting this kind of homophobia in Africa. And we have every right to withdraw that funding, and the Obama administration should, in fact, do so. Further, U.S. monies flow to institutions like Christian University in Uganda through our USAID funding. These funds go to support a university that is a training ground for this kind of bigotry, that in fact won't allow homosexual students to even enroll, will not allow a faculty member who is not straight and married to even teach at the university. Again, the United States has the capacity, quietly but forcefully, to say we're not going to use your and my tax dollars to fund this kind of vicious violation of human rights of our African brothers and sisters, and the Obama administration must take that very seriously.
That was Tarso Ramos, Executive Director of Political Research Associates, and Reverend Kapia Kayoma, an Anglican priest from Zambia who is the author of PRA's report, Globalizing the Culture Wars, U.S. Conservatives, African Churches, and Homophobia. Read the report online at publiceye.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Mansari.